I'd just like to start by saying that was the title of my paper. It probably is still, except it's changed a bit. So it's not necessarily just about cookery dogs anymore. So I'm sorry if you were disappointed, but hopefully not. Okay, so this paper continues a conversation started by another anthropologist called Molly Mullen, who wrote an article for Feeding Animals, which you can find in her edited collection, Where the Wild Things Are Now, Domestication Reconsidered. Mullen discusses the pet food industry, also what are known as raw or natural diets, both of which are subjects I'm going to talk a little bit about today, in relation to the way people understand the health and well-being of their dogs. A lot's been written, especially in the veterinary literature, about pet owners' feeding practices and how these practices shape the bodies of dogs, especially when it comes to the problems of non-compliance with manufacturer and veterinary recommendations. Moving on from this, I've been thinking a bit about how feeding practices and canine bodies are shaped by the relationships between companion animals and their carers. And just to make clear where this is coming from, I've spent several years conducting ethnographic research on breeders of pedigree dogs in the UK. My early research looked at working sled dogs, and now I'm looking at pedigree show dogs. So any of you who are familiar with dogs and dog breeders will know that dog food and feeding practices are often highly politicised. I won't go too far into the history of pet food production, but as Molly Mullen has noted, a shift in pet keeping habits in Western societies in the mid-20th century meant that a lot of people who had no prior experience looking after animals were suddenly caring for domestic pets. The pet food industry had emerged in the late 19th century Britain and the United States from the grain and meatpacking industry and grew rapidly, managing to convince the public that pets needed specialist species-specific food, which was best formulated by scientists in a laboratory. And that the industry focuses now on this high-end complete foods. Complete foods basically are designed to meet all the calorific and nutritional needs of the dog. these are designed for particular types and breeds of dog, or aimed at dogs with particular lifestyles. Manufacturers draw on the ever-developing scientific knowledge of breed-specific illness and genetic profiles to suggest that animals of particular shapes, sizes, and dispositions require tailor-made solutions to the problems that arise as a result of these characteristics. This sort of specialist scientific food, as it's often called, is familiar to most breeders and dog owners, certainly those who regularly visit a veterinary practice. Brands such as Hill's and Royal Canin are heavily promoted by vets, to the point where virtually all practice waiting rooms now have stands filled with ranges of scientific food aimed at dogs in different phases of life. as you can see here, we've got companies that have developed all these specific food. We've got food for puppies, pregnant and lactating bitches, neutered dogs, sporting dogs, right through to elderly dogs. Most recently, Royal Canin has developed a range of kibble for urban dogs who, quote, may be exposed to a polluted environment which may cause oxidative stress, so it contains an exclusive range of antioxidants known for their beneficial effects, along with, quote, specific fish nutrients to aid brain development and help dogs cope with noisy situations they may encounter in the course of city life. In the formulation and promotion of these specialist products, each stage of the canine life course is medicalized to the point that it requires scientifically formulated foods to stave off apparent pathologies, such as overly rapid growth or age-related degeneration. Even beyond these now standard foods for dogs at particular stages of life, both Hill's and Royal Canin offer prescription foods for dogs with particular health problems. In last count, Royal Canin Veterinary Diet offered 47 different foods designed to respond to concerns including diabetes, obesity, and skin complaints. This is a screenshot from the Royal Canin webpage showing products in the veterinary range. You can see this is page 1 of 5 different pages with these products on. And these are some quotes from some of the descriptions of the products in the veterinary range. In addition to these clinical diets, Royal Canin's 23 breed-specific ranges offer, quote, tailor-made nutrition for purebred dogs. These foods are said to provide, quote, unique ingredients and flavours. Each kibble is produced in a particular size to fit the jaws of the breed. As could be expected, many of these foods claim to reduce the severity of breed-related health problems. In short, since the 20th century, the pet food industry has suggested that, as Molly Mullen puts it, domestication creates problems, but technological innovation can solve these. And Dalmatians are a case in point. The breed's prone to developing urinary stones, and as such, Royal Canin's range, quote, helps maintain a healthy urinary system thanks to adaptive protein sources. To summarise the problem briefly, unlike most other dogs, Dalmatians are not able to fully metabolise certain proteins, which are instead excreted into the kidneys by the urine as uric acid. High levels of uric acid in Dalmatians' urine predispose them to kidney and bladder stones. It's estimated that between 10 and 30% of Dalmatians will develop stone disease at some point in life. These stones can cause urethral blockages, which can ultimately lead to the death of the dog. Like many health problems in pedigree dogs, high levels of uric acid are linked to selective breeding. Now, other breeds have a gene which regulates the breakdown of protein and the production of uric acid, but this has been lost from the Dalmatian. In recent decades, though, a growing number of breeders have become involved in a project to reintroduce the so-called normal uric acid gene through changes in breeding practice. So this is the Dalmatian food. And this is Fiona, who's become quite well known in the show world. She is a Kennel Club registered pedigree Dalmatian bred as part of what is known as the LUA Backcross Project, which was set up in the United States in the 1970s. In brief, the Backcross Project involved crossing a Dalmatian with a dog from another breed, a pointer, to reintroduce the gene that would control the production of uric acid. The puppies from the LUA Backcross were bred back to Dalmatians, and today there's an established population of low uric acid Dalmatians. Some, like Fiona, have been imported to Europe, where they've been bred with Dalmatians from local populations and are producing low uric acid puppies. All of Fiona's known ancestors are Dalmatians, except for the pointer, which features in the 14th generation of her pedigree. Now, advocates of the Backcross claim that the project has allowed them to solve the problem of high uric acid while maintaining the appearance and temperament of the breed. However, most Dalmatian breed clubs, the UK Breed Club among them, and many breeders are against what they view as crossbreeding and argue that the problem of high uric acid can be controlled with a specialised low-protein diet. In recent years, pet food manufacturers like Royal Canin have picked up on the issue and now offer for sale specially formulated low-protein foods for Dalmatians, which claim to minimise the risk of stone formations and blockages. As one breeder and club member explained, quote, all good breeders explain to puppy buyers that they need to buy specialist food for their Dalmatians and control their diet very carefully. In short, most breeders advocate controlling the problem through the use of veterinary treatments and medicalised diets, rather than attempting to solve it through changes in breeding practice. Of course, advocates of the LUA Backcross disagree with this approach, and some suggest that the availability of specialist medical diets, like this one, that aim to deal with breed-related problems distract from the need to fundamentally rethink current breeding practices. Not only this, but some argue that a strict diet of prescription food is quite simply not all that interesting for their dogs. On the one hand then, the range of specialist diets available offers people new means to care for pedigree dog companions, although arguably these means are accompanied by an imperative to provide care through the consumption of costly branded products. At the same time, it might be argued that responsibility for preventing inheritable health problems is placed primarily on the carer who, like caretakers of Dalmatians, are charged with supplying specialist foods to keep the disease at bay. Moreover, critics argue, clinical veterinary diets contribute to the normalisation of disease in certain breeds and frame the problem of pedigree dogs' ill health as one to be tackled through increased consumption of veterinary products rather than through changes in breeding. So these are some of the concerns raised about clinical diets. Hopefully this gives you some idea as to how these products are tied into discussions about breed health. But to move on to the second point of this paper, many of these discussions very much focus on dogs as biomechanical objects of veterinary scientific thinking. Indeed, for some breeders I work with, feeding is simply about maintaining the physical body of the dog, very much in line with what we might think of as a stockman's attitude towards animal care. But to many caretakers of companion animals, feeding regimes are not merely about ensuring optimal physiological health and outward appearance. Food also provides a means for people to care for dogs as subjects rather than simply as biological objects. Many carers feel that food is an experience to be enjoyed. After all, the consumption of food is a relational sensory experience that crosses the species divide. Informants often remark that complete dog food is boring. and question why their companions should be expected to eat dry biscuits day in, day out. In short, the vast majority of caretakers recognise that their dogs have their own tastes when it comes to food, take seriously the fact that dogs enjoy a subjective experience of different flavours and textures in their diet. And while scientifically formulated diets provide people with a means to care for their animals in one particular way, to provide a diet aimed at improving physical health, the same diets do not offer much scope to provide other kinds of care through the giving of food. So how do caretakers respond? Well, many simply adjust their companions' diets to provide a variation, mixing complete dry foods with natural yogurt, rice, oats, tinned fish, grated apple, cheese, carrots, a whole range of food that they know the dogs enjoy. But these are practices that the pet food industry is highly critical of. The website of Hill's Pet Food, for instance, warns that, quote, it's very important that the therapeutic dog food is fed exclusively in order to work effectively. It's therefore recommended not to mix Hill's with other food. If you wish to offer your dog a more varied diet, talk to your vet about complementing your dog's dry food with Hill's Science Plan or Hill's Prescription Diet Wet Products, the only wet food solutions to effectively complement Hill's dry food. And while carers might be tempted to treat their animals with other foods and flavours, the company warned that other types of food, quote, do not provide your dog with the correct balance of nutrients, and treats may lead to weight gain or nutritional imbalance. The Pet Food Manufacturers Association agrees with the people at Hill's, concluding that, quote, many human owners are over-humanising pets, with one in three feeding pets human food treats, unknowingly putting their pets at risk. Other websites and reports from the pet food industry use similar punitive language, often asserting species difference to describe the way in which caretakers' feeding habits fail to adhere to guidelines set by manufacturers. But is to treat a companion animal with special food necessarily over-humanising, or is the relationship between companion species perhaps more complex and nuanced than these reports suggest? Here we can look at the work of another anthropologist called Kay Milton, who's asked us to consider whether it is in fact anthropomorphism which is at play in our relationships with individual animals, or rather what Milton refers to as egomorphism, in which we think of animals as individual subject beings in their own right, rather than as simply humans in fur coats. I don't think many of my informants mistook their companion animals for humans, or wanted them to be such, but caretakers did feel strongly about providing dogs with a varied and interesting diet, much as they enjoyed themselves. And while there are no doubt caretakers who feed their dogs salty, fatty, processed foods, the majority of my informants spent a significant amount of time researching and producing treats and meal supplements for their dogs. Plenty of times I've walked into a kitchen to smell liver cake baking in the oven, or I have been charged with stuffing Kong toys with peanut butter and sardines mixed together. It's delicious, apparently. So, raw diets. A number of dog breeders and caretakers that I've worked with have rejected manufactured food entirely in favour of raw diets, or natural diets as they're sometimes called. Again, I refer you back to Molly Mullen's article for a more in-depth discussion of the historical emergence of raw feeding and the different schools of thought on the matter. But the point I'd like to make here is that raw feeding is very much viewed as a holistic solution to concerns over canine health and well-being. Firstly, as Mullen noted, raw feeding allows caretakers to take seriously the wild origins of the species by feeding them a carnivorous diet that's closer to that of their lupine ancestors. What I found working with different breeds is that some breeders, notably breeders of sled dogs and huskies and malamutes, were so keen to provide species-appropriate diets that they would seek out foods closest to that, to those which they imagined their breeds would eat in the wild. So for huskies, for instance, owners would feed their dogs a lot of pork because they thought pork was, or they understand pork to be closest to caribou, which was the main part of a natural diet in the Russian or Alaskan Arctic. These same breeders also fed lots of oily fish, chicken carcasses, and supplements such as like kelp powder and even actually seal oil capsules that they imported from Canada in order to provide the animals with the diet they imagined were best suited to that specific breed. So I've spared you some of the gory details of raw feeding because I know a lot of you guys are vegetarian and vegan. But here are some pictures. These are rather inventive raw meals. This one's from a raw feeding Facebook group called Raw Feeding Rebels. It's a filler for Kong toys, and it's got ox heart and green tripe and spinach and almonds in this one. These are Kongs filled with this stuffing with some fish for good measure. This is another recipe, this one again for filling Kongs or perhaps cow hooves. This is the recipe here. Among other things, we've got salmon oil, coconut oil, kelp powder, caraway seeds, all kinds of tasty, interesting things. So pet food manufacturers as well have certainly picked up on the trend towards what are seen as natural foods for pets. Hills, for example, now produce what is called the Ideal Balance range, made up, they claim, of, quote, natural ingredients perfectly balanced. So you can see, this is from their website, the Hills website, you can see how the emphasis here is on natural ingredients in their raw state as well. But of course, the manufacturers are quick to point out that although the ingredients may be natural, nature cannot be relied upon to provide complete balanced nutrition the way that science can. As the Hills website puts it, quote, creating a natural pet food is one thing, creating a perfectly balanced one to meet Hills' high standards is another. So the implication then is that while carers' concerns about feeding their dogs high quality natural food are legitimate, pet food manufacturers are still best placed to oversee their doing so. But again, the products marketed come in the form of a complete kibble, and as mentioned previously, caretakers' concerns extend far beyond the provision of adequate nutrition that manufacturers aim to provide. The constituents of a raw diet, for example, are seen as promoting the mental well-being of dogs by providing them with a range of stimulating experiences. It's widely agreed among raw feeders that chewing on large bones provides intellectual stimulation for dogs, and that chewing is a natural behaviour and part of a balanced life. Providing bones and snacks to chew on is something feeders of both raw and manufactured diets do, but again, is something that doesn't figure much in the discourse surrounding complete veterinary diets, except as a negative aspect of human behaviour. In short, all-in-one solutions provided in the form of complete food do not fit. They might offer a complete range of nutrients, but not of experiences, which, as many caretakers are concerned, is an equally significant part of eating for their dogs. Ultimately, industry discourse suggests that the irresponsible feeding habits of animal caretakers and the want to treat animals with human food have led to what's commonly referred to as the pet beast epidemic. The implication from the pet food industry is that carers of overweight and obese dogs have failed in their duty to protect their companions. In line with this thinking, the Pet Food Manufacturers Association 2014 report suggests that carers need to feed pets according to food manufacturers' guidelines and resist the temptation to provide them with treats and tidbits. But foods, especially treat foods, are as much a part of our social and caring relationships with companion animals as they are between humans. Most behavioural training involves giving food as a reward, and providing and sharing food is widely recognised as a means to promote the bond between animals and humans. As sociologist Mayer and all argue, when parents, frequently mothers, provide food to children, they're not only providing for their physical needs. They are, quote, simultaneously constructing care and building family, giving material expression to central intimacies and commitments of love, care and responsibility. Put quite simply, just as we treat ourselves, our friends, our children to special foods, so too we treat our dogs. And as between humans, food and eating is often used as a means to compensate for and help to overcome difficult situations. Providing treats such as toys stuffed with fatty foods, like peanut butter, for example, might make leaving dogs alone easier for both carer and dog, or may simply be a means to entertain a bored dog at times when the carer cannot provide exercise or other distractions. More controversially, some breeders critical of the pet food industry suggest that it's not only problematic breeding practices that dog food manufacturers are supporting, but also problematic pet keeping practices, namely that dogs kept as house pets are often left alone for many hours of the day and often isolated from other members of their species. Clinical diets are now offering to relieve dogs' stress and anxiety. Royal Canin's Calm range, for instance, is advertised as being formulated with, this is difficult, alpha S1 casein tripsic hydrosalate with an adequate content of tryptophan to help maintain emotional balance. As with other clinical diets, critics argue that these products contribute to the individualization and medicalization of problems which are inherently social. Ultimately, encouraging pet keeping practices which are in the interests of neither humans or dogs. As we can learn from social scientists working in human healthcare, critiques of the individualization of health are vital if we're to get to grips with the complexity of these so-called epidemics, such as obesity and behavioral problems, in either humans or companion species, particularly when it comes to understandings of responsibility and agency on the part of the various actors involved. Rather than reducing feeding practices to a matter of supply and control of calories, we might perhaps move towards an understanding that feeding is something that takes place in a broader social and material context of care, provision, and nurture. And while so-called complete foods might be scientifically tailored to meet the nutritional requirements of dogs, we might ask whether they fulfill the other roles that food plays in subjective relationships between companion species. If they don't, is it the nature of these relationships that we need to change, or is it perhaps also up to the pet food industry to rethink the products they're offering, and most importantly, to rethink their understanding of the relationships people share with their dogs?